Chapter 23. London. Catherine Blake assumed that Allied officers who knew the most important secret of the war had been made aware of the threat posed by spies. Why else would Commander Peter Jordan handcuff his briefcase to his wrist for a short walk across Grosvenor Square? She also assumed that officers had been warned about approaches by women. Earlier in the war, she had seen a poster outside a club frequented by British officers. It showed a luscious, big-breasted blonde in a low-cut evening gown, waiting for an officer to light her cigarette for her. Across the bottom of the poster were the words, "Keep it mum, she's not so dumb." Catherine thought it was the most ridiculous thing she had ever seen. If there were women like that, tarts who hung around clubs or parties listening for gossip and secrets, she did not know about them. She did suspect that such indoctrination would make Peter Jordan distrustful of a beautiful woman suddenly vying for his attention. He was also a successful, intelligent, and attractive man. He would be very discriminating in the women he chose to spend time with. The scene at the Savoy the other night was evidence of that. He had become angry with his friend Shepherd Ramsay for setting him up with a young, stupid girl. Catherine would have to make her approach very carefully. Which explained why she was standing on a corner near the Van Dyke Club with a bag of groceries in her arms. It was shortly before 6 o'clock. London was shrouded in the blackout. The evening traffic gave off just enough light for her to see the doorway of the club. A few minutes later, a man of medium height and build emerged. It was Peter Jordan. He paused for a moment to button his overcoat. If he kept to his evening routine, he would walk the short distance to his house. If he broke his routine by flagging down a taxi, Catherine would be out of luck. She would be forced to come back again tomorrow night with her bag of groceries. Jordan turned up the collar of his overcoat and started walking her way. Catherine Blake waited for a moment and then stepped directly in front of him. When they collided, there was the sound of paper splitting and tins of food tumbling to the pavement. "I'm sorry, I didn't see you there. Please, let me help you up."
"No, it's my fault. I'm afraid I've misplaced my blackout torch and I've been wandering around out here lost. I feel like such a fool."
"No, it's my fault. I was trying to prove to myself that I could find my way home in the dark. Here, I have a torch. Let me turn it on."
"Do you mind turning the beam toward the pavement? I believe my rations are rolling toward Hyde Park."
"Here, take my hand."
"Thank you. By the way, you can stop shining the light in my face any time now."
"I'm sorry, you're just..."
"Just what?"
"Never mind. I don't think that sack of flour survived."
"That's all right.
Here, let me help you pick these things up."
"I can manage, thank you."
"No, I insist. And let me replace the flour for you. I have plenty of food at my house. My problem is I don't know what to do with it."
"Doesn't the Navy feed you?"
"How did..."
"I'm afraid the uniform and the accent gave you away. Besides, only an American officer would be silly enough to intentionally walk the streets of London without using a torch. I've lived here all my life, and I still can't find my way round in the blackout."
"Please, let me replace the things you've lost."
"That's a very kind offer, but it's not necessary. It was a pleasure bumping into you."
"Yes, yes, it was."
"Can you kindly point me in the direction of Brompton Road?"
"It's that way."
"Thank you very much."
She turned and started to walk away. "Hold on a minute. I have another suggestion." She stopped walking and turned around.
"And what might that be?"
"I wonder if you might have a drink with me sometime." She hesitated, then said,
"I'm not sure I want a drink with a frightful American who insists on walking the streets of London without a torch. But I suppose you look harmless enough. So the answer is yes."
She walked away again. "Wait, come back. I don't even know your name."
"It's Catherine," she called.
"Catherine Blake." "I need your telephone number," Jordan said helplessly. But she had melted into the darkness and was gone.
When Peter Jordan arrived home, he went into his study, picked up the telephone, and dialed. He identified himself, and a pleasant female voice instructed him to remain on the line. A moment later, he heard the English-accented voice of the man he knew only as Broom. Chapter 24. Kent, England.
Alfred Vickery was being stretched to the breaking point. Despite the intense pressure to capture the spies, Vickery had kept his old caseload, the Becker Network. He had considered asking to be relieved of it until after the spies had been arrested, but he quickly rejected the idea. He was the genius behind the Becker Network. It was his masterpiece. It had taken countless hours to build and countless more to sustain. He would keep control of it and try to capture the spies at the same time. It was a brutal assignment. His right eye was beginning to twitch the way it did during final examinations at Cambridge, and he recognized the early symptoms of nervous exhaustion. Partridge was the code name of a degenerate lorry driver whose routes happened to take him into restricted military zones in Suffolk, Kent, and East Sussex. He subscribed to the beliefs of Sir Oswald Mosley, the British fascist, and he used the money he made from spying to buy whores. Sometimes he brought the girls along on his trips so they could give him sex while he drove. He liked Carl Becker because Becker always had a young girl stashed away, and he was always willing to share, even with the likes of Partridge. But Partridge existed only in Vickery's imagination, on the airwaves, and in the minds of his German control officers in Hamburg. Luftwaffe surveillance photos had detected new activity in southeast England, and Berlin had asked Becker to assess the enemy activity and report back within 1 week. Becker had given the assignment to Partridge, or rather, Vickery had done it for him. It was the opportunity Vickery had been waiting for, an invitation from the Abwehr to transmit false intelligence about the Ersatz 1st United States Army Group being assembled in southeast England. Partridge, according to Vickery's concocted scenario, had driven through the Kent countryside at midday. In fact, Vickery had journeyed the same route that morning in the back of a department rover. From his perch on the leather seat, wrapped in a travelling rug, Vickery imagined the signs of a military build-up an agent like Partridge might see. He might see more military lorries on the road. He might spot a group of American officers at the pub where he ate lunch. At the garage where he stopped for petrol, he might hear rumors that nearby roads were being widened. The information was trivial, the clues small, but totally consistent with Partridge's cover. Vickery couldn't allow him to discover something extraordinary like General Patton's field headquarters. His Abwehr controllers would never believe an agent like Partridge was capable of that. But Partridge's small clues, when incorporated into the rest of the deception scheme, would help paint the picture British intelligence wanted the Germans to see, a massive Allied force waiting to strike across the Channel at Calais. Vickery composed Partridge's message as he rode back into London. The report would be encoded into an Abwehr cipher, and Carl Becker would transmit it to Hamburg late that evening from his cell. Vickery envisioned another night with little or no rest. When he finished the message, he closed his eyes and leaned his head against the window, wadding his Macintosh into a ball for a pillow. The swaying of the rover and the low rumble of its engine lulled him into a light, fitful sleep. He dreamed of France again, except this time it was Boothby, not Brendan Evans, who came to him in the field hospital.
1,000 men are dead, Alfred, and it's all your fault. If you had captured the spies, they'd be alive today.
Vickery forced open his eyes and caught a glimpse of the passing countryside before drifting off again. This time he is lying in bed on a fine spring morning 25 years ago, the morning he made love to Helen for the first time. He is spending the weekend at the sprawling estate owned by Helen's father. Through his bedroom window, Vickery can see the morning sun gradually casting a pink light over the hillsides. It is the day they plan to inform Helen's father of their plans to marry. He hears the gentle knock at the door. In his dream it sounds exactly the same, and turns his head just in time to spot Helen, beautiful and fresh from sleep, slipping into his room wearing nothing but a white nightgown. She climbs into bed next to him and kisses him on the mouth.
"I've been thinking about you all morning, Alfred, darling."
She reaches beneath the blanket, unties his pajamas, and touches him lightly with her long, beautiful fingers.
"Helen, I thought you wanted to wait until we were..."
She quiets him by kissing his lips.
"I don't want to discuss it any more. We have to hurry, though. If Daddy finds out, he'll kill us both.
She straddles his hips, carefully, so she doesn't hurt his knee. She lifts her nightgown and guides him with her hands. There is a moment of resistance. Helen presses down harder, utters a short gasp of pain, and he is inside her. She draws his hands to her breasts. He has touched them before, but only through her clothing and stiff underwear. Now they are free within her gown, and they feel soft and wonderful. He tries to unbutton her gown, but she won't let him.
Quickly, darling, quickly.
When it is over, he wants her to stay, to hold her and do it all over again. But she quickly straightens her nightgown, kisses him, and hurries back to her room. Vickery awakened in the eastern suburbs of London, a slight smile on his face. He had not found the first time with Helen disappointing. It was just different from what he expected. The sex of his youthful fantasies always involved women with enormous breasts who screamed and cried with ecstasy. But with Helen, it had been slow and gentle, and instead of screaming, she smiled and kissed him tenderly. It was not passionate, but it was perfect. And it was perfect because he loved her desperately. It was that way with Alice Simpson, too, but for other reasons. Vickery was fond of her. He even supposed he might be in love with her, whatever that meant. More than anything else, he enjoyed her company. She was intelligent and witty, and like Helen, a touch irreverent. She taught literature at a minor school for girls, and wrote mediocre plays about rich people who always seemed to have cathartic, life-altering discourse while sipping pale sherry and Earl Grey tea in a handsomely furnished drawing-room. She also wrote romantic novels under a pseudonym, which Vickery, while not a fan of the genre, thought were rather good. Once Lillian Walford, his secretary at University College, caught him reading one of Alice Simpson's books. The next day she brought him a stack of Barbara Cartland novels. Vickery was mortified. The characters in Alice's novels, when they made love, all heard waves crashing and felt the heavens raining down on them. In real life, she was shy and tender and somewhat ticklish, and she always insisted on making love in the dark. More than once, Vickery closed his eyes and saw the image of Helen in her white nightgown, bathed in morning sunlight. His relationship with Alice Simpson had lapsed with the war. They still spoke at least once a week. She had lost her flat early in the Blitz, and stayed in Vickery's house in Chelsea for a time. They saw each other occasionally for dinner, but it had been months since they had made love. He realized suddenly that this was the first time Alice Simpson had entered his thoughts since Edward Kenton, walking across the drive of Matilda's cottage, had spoken Helen's name. Ham Common, Surrey. The large, rather ugly, three-story Victorian mansion was surrounded by a pair of perimeter fences and a picket to shield it from view from the outside world. Nissen huts had been erected around the 10-acre grounds to house most of the staff. Once it had been known as Latchmere House, an asylum and recuperation centre for victims of shell shock during the First War. But in 1939 it was converted into MI5's main interrogation and incarceration centre, and assigned the military designation Camp 020. The room into which Vickery was shown smelled of mildew, disinfectant, and vaguely of boiled cabbage. There was no place to hang his coat. The Intelligence Corps guards went to great lengths to guard against suicide, so he kept it on. Besides, the place was like a medieval dungeon, cold, damp, a breeding ground for bronchial infection. The room had one feature that made it highly functional, a tiny arrow slit of a window through which an aerial had been strung. Vickery opened the lid on the Abwehr-issue suitcase radio he had brought with him, the very one he had seized from Becker in 1940. He attached the aerial and switched on the power. The lights glowed yellow as Vickery selected the proper frequency. He yawned and stretched. It was 11:45 p.m. Becker was scheduled to send his message at midnight. He thought, damn, why does the Abwehr always choose such god-awful hours for their agents to send messages? Karl Becker was a liar, a thief, and a sexual deviant, a man without morals or loyalty. Yet he could be charming and intelligent, and over the years Becker and Vickery had developed something approaching a professional friendship. He came into the room, sandwiched between a pair of hulking guards, hands cuffed. The guards removed the cuffs and wordlessly went out. Becker smiled and stuck out his hand. Vickery shook it. It was cool as cellar limestone. There was a small table of rough-hewn wood and a pair of battered old chairs. Vickery and Becker sat down on opposite sides of the table, as if facing off for a game of chess. The edges of the table had been burned black by unattended cigarettes. Vickery handed Becker a small package, and like a child he opened it right away. In it were a half dozen packets of cigarettes and a box of Swiss chocolates. Becker looked at the things, then at Vickery.
"Cigarettes and chocolate? You're not here to seduce me, are you, Alfred?"
Becker managed a small chuckle, but prison life had changed him. His lustrous French suits had been replaced with a dour grey overall, neatly pressed and surprisingly well-fitted through the shoulders. Officially, he was on a suicide watch, which Vickery thought was absurd, and he wore flimsy canvas slippers with no laces. His skin, once deeply tanned, had faded to a dungeon white. His taut little body had assumed a sudden discipline imposed by small places. Gone were the flailing arms and abandoned laughter that Vickery had seen in the old surveillance photographs. He sat ramrod straight, as though someone were holding a gun to his back, and arranged the chocolate, cigarettes and matches as if he were laying down a boundary across which Vickery was not to venture. Becker opened a packet of cigarettes and tapped out two of them, giving one to Vickery and keeping one for himself. He struck a match and held it out to Vickery before lighting his own cigarette. They sat in silence for a while, each studying his own spot on the cell wall. Old chums who have told every story they know, and now are content just to be in each other's presence. Becker savored his cigarette, rolling the smoke on his tongue like an excellent Bordeaux before blowing it in a slender stream at the low stone ceiling. In the tiny chamber, smoke gathered overhead like storm clouds.
"Please send my love to Harry," Becker finally said.
"I will.
He's a good man, a bit on the dogged side, like all policemen, but he's not a bad sort."
"I'd be lost without him."
"And how's Brother Boothby?"
Vickery let out a long breath.
"As ever."
"We all have our Nazis, Alfred."
"We're thinking of sending him over to the other side."
Becker, laughing, used the stub of his cigarette to light another.
"I see you've brought my radio," he said. "What heroic deed have I done for the Third Reich now?"
"You've broken into number 10 and stolen all the Prime Minister's private papers."
Becker threw his head back and emitted a short, brutal burst of laughter.
"I hope I'm demanding more money from those cheap bastards, and not the counterfeit that got me into trouble last time."
"Of course."
Becker looked at the radio, then at Vickery.
"In the good old days, you would have left a revolver on the table and let me do the deed myself. Now you bring a radio made by some fine, upstanding German company and let me kill myself a dot and a dash at a time."
"It is a terrible world in which we live, Karl, but no one forced you to become a spy."
"Better than the Wehrmacht," Becker said. "I'm an old man, like you, Alfred. I would be conscripted and sent off to the east to fight the fucking Ivans. No, thank you. I'll wait out the war right here in my pleasant little English sanitarium."
Vickery glanced at his watch. 10 minutes until Becker was scheduled to go on the air. He reached inside his pocket and withdrew the coded message Becker was to send. Then he took out the photograph taken from the passport of the Dutch woman named Christa Kunst. A look of distant recollection flashed across Becker's face, then dissipated.
"You know who she is, don't you, Karl?"
"You've found Anna," he said, smiling. "Well done, Alfred. Well done indeed. Bravo!"
Vickery sat like a man straining to hear distant music, hands folded on the table, making no notes. He knew it was best to ask as few questions as possible, best to allow Becker to lead him where he wanted. Like a deerstalker, Vickery made no movements, stayed downwind. His cigarette, untouched, burned to grey dust in the metal ashtray at his elbow. Through the arrow-slit window he could hear an evening rainstorm smacking on the exercise yard. As always, Becker started the story somewhere in the middle, and with himself. He held his body with a regimental stillness for a time, but as the story built he began waving his arms and using his precise little fingers to weave a tapestry before Vickery's eyes. Like all Becker monologues, there were blind alleys and detours for accounts of bravery, money-making, and sexual conquest. At times he would lapse into a long, speculative silence. At other times he would tell it so quickly he would be overcome with a fit of coughing. "It's the goddamn damp in my cell," he said by way of explanation. "That's one thing you English do very well." "People like me, they get almost no training," he said. "Oh, sure, a few lectures by some idiots in Berlin who've never seen England except on a map. This is how you estimate the size of an army, they tell you. This is how you use your radio. This is how you bite into your suicide capsule in the highly unlikely event that MI5 kicks down your door. Then they send you off to England in a boat or a plane to win the war for the Führer." He paused to light another cigarette and open the box of chocolates. "I was lucky. I was posing as a legal. I came by plane with a Swiss passport. You know what they did to another fellow? Put him ashore in Sussex in a rubber raft. But the U-boat left France without special unmarked Abwehr rafts. They had to use one of the U-boat's life rafts with a Kriegsmarine insignia on it. Can you believe such a thing?" Vickery could believe it. The Abwehr was horrendously slipshod with the way it prepared and inserted its agents into England. He remembered the boy he pulled off the Cornish beach in September 1940. The special branch men who searched him found in his pocket a packet of matches from a popular Berlin nightclub. Then there was the case of Gösta Karoli, a Swedish citizen who parachuted into Northamptonshire near the village of Denton. He was discovered by an Irish farmhand named Paddy Daly, sleeping beneath a hedge. He wore a decent suit of grey flannel and a tie knotted continental style. Karoli admitted he had parachuted into England and handed over his automatic pistol and £300 in cash. The local authorities passed him on to MI5, and he was promptly taken to Camp 020. Becker popped one of the chocolates into his mouth and held the box out to Vickery. "You British took the espionage business more seriously than we Germans. You had to, because you were weak. You had to use deception and trickery to mask your frailty. But now you've got the Abwehr by the balls." "But there were others they took more care with," Vickery said. "Yes, there were others. Different kinds of agents." "Absolutely," Becker said, as he dug out another chocolate. "These are delicious, Alfred. Are you sure you won't have one?" Becker was a surprisingly precise keyer. Precise and very fast. Vickery attributed this to the fact that he was a classically trained violinist before his life took whatever unfortunate turn it was that landed him where he was now. Vickery listened on a spare pair of headphones as Becker identified himself and waited for the confirmation signal from the operator in Hamburg. As always, it gave Vickery a brief chill. He took enormous pleasure from the fact that he was deceiving the enemy, lying to him so skillfully. He enjoyed the intimate contact, being able to hear the enemy's voice, even if it was just an electronic bleep amid a vapor of atmospheric hiss. Vickery imagined how appalled he would feel if he were the one being deceived. For some reason, he found himself thinking of Helen. The Hamburg operator ordered Becker to proceed. Becker looked down at Vickery's message and quickly tapped it out. When he was finished, he waited for Hamburg to confirm, then signed off. Vickery slipped off his headphones and shut off the radio. Becker would sulk for a while. He always did after sending one of Vickery's double-cross messages, like a man who feels the hot flash of guilt after copulating with his mistress and wishes to be alone with his troubled thoughts. Vickery always suspected Becker was ashamed of betraying his own service, that his rantings about Abwehr bumbling and incompetence were just an attempt to conceal his own guilt over being a failure and a coward. Not that he had much of a choice. The first time Becker refused to send one of Vickery's messages, he would be marched off to Wandsworth Prison for an appointment with the hangman. Vickery feared he had lost him. Becker smoked, and he ate a few more chocolates without offering any to Vickery. Vickery slowly packed away the radio.
"I saw her once in Berlin," Becker said suddenly. "She was immediately separated from the rest of us mere mortals. I don't want you to quote me on this, Alfred. I'm just going to tell you what I heard. The rumors, the talk. If it doesn't turn out to be totally accurate, I don't want Stevens to come in here and start throwing me off the fucking walls."
Vickery nodded sympathetically. Stevens was Colonel R.W.G. Stevens, the commandant of Camp 020, better known as Tin Eye. A former Indian Army officer, Stevens was monocled, maniacal, and always dressed immaculately in a forage cap and uniform of the Peshawar Rifles. He was half German and spoke the language fluently. He was also detested by the prisoners and MI5 staff alike. Once he had given Vickery a thorough public dressing down because he arrived 5 minutes late for an interrogation. Even senior staff like Boothby were not immune to his tirades and fits of vile temper.
"You have my word, Carl," Vickery said, taking his place at the table again. "They said her name was Anna Steiner, that her father was some sort of aristocrat. Prussian, rich bastard, dueling scar on the cheek, dabbled in diplomacy. You know the type, don't you?"
Becker didn't wait for an answer. "Christ, she was beautiful. Tall as hell. Spoke perfectly accented British English. The rumors said she had an English mother. That she was living in Spain the summer of 36, fucking some Spanish fascist bastard named Romero. Turns out Senor Romero was a talent spotter for the Abwehr. He calls Berlin, collects a finder's fee, and hands her over. The Abwehr puts the screws to her. They tell lovely Anna that her fatherland needs her. If she doesn't cooperate, Papa von Steiner gets shipped off to a concentration camp."
"Who was her control officer?"
"I don't know his name. Sour-looking bastard. Smart, like you, only ruthless."
"Was his name Fogel?"
"I don't know. Could be."
"You never saw her again?"
"No, just that once."
"So what happened to her?"
Becker was overcome by another fit of coughing that a fresh cigarette seemed to cure.
"I'm telling you what I heard, not what I know. You understand the difference?"
"I understand the difference." "We heard there was a camp somewhere in the mountains south of Munich. Very isolated, all surrounding roads closed. Hell for the locals. According to the rumors, it was a place where they sent a few special agents, the ones they planned to bury deep."
"She was one of those agents?"
"Yes, Alfred. We've covered that ground already. Stay with me, please." Becker was digging through the chocolates again. "It was as if an English village had dropped from the sky and landed in the middle of Bavaria. There was a pub, a small hotel, cottages, even an Anglican church. Each agent was assigned to a cottage for a minimum stay of 6 months. In the morning, they read London newspapers at the cafe over tea and buns. They did their shopping in English and listened to popular radio programs of the day on the BBC. Me, I never heard 'It's That Man' again until I came to London."
"Go on."
"They had special codes and special rendezvous procedures. They were given more weapons training. Silent killing. At night, they even sent the boys English-speaking whores so they could fuck in English."
"And what about the woman?"
"They say she was fucking her control officer. What did you say his name was? Fogel?" "Again, it was only a rumor."
"Did you ever meet her in Britain?"
"No."
"I want the truth, Carl!"
Vickery snapped, so loudly that one of the guards stuck his head inside the door to make sure there was no problem.
"I'm telling you the truth! Jesus Christ, you're Alfred Vickery one minute and Heinrich Himmler the next! I never saw her again!"
Vickery switched to German. He didn't want the guards eavesdropping on the conversation.
"Do you know her cover name?"
"No." Becker responded in the same language. "Do you know her address?"
"No."
"Do you know if she's operating in London?"
"She could be operating on the moon, for all I know."
Vickery exhaled loudly in frustration. It was all interesting information, but like the discovery of Beatrice Pym's murder, it put him no closer to his quarry.
"Have you told me everything you know about her, Carl?"
Becca smiled. She's supposed to be an incredible fuck.
Becca noticed the color in Vickery's cheeks.
I'm sorry, Alfred. Jesus Christ, I forget what a prude you are sometimes.
Still speaking in German, Vickery said,
Why haven't you told us this before? The business about the special agents.
But I have, Alfred, old man.
Who have you told? You've never told me.
I told Boothby.
Vickery felt blood streaming to his face, and his heart began to beat furiously.
Boothby? Why in the world would Boothby be interrogating Carl Becker? And why would he do it without Vickery being present? Becker was his agent. Vickery arrested him. Vickery turned him. Vickery ran him.
His face calm, Vickery said,
When did you tell Boothby?
I don't know. It's hard to keep track of time in here. A couple of months ago, September maybe. No, maybe it was October. Yes, I believe October.
What did you tell him exactly?
I told him about the agents. I told him about the camp.
Did you tell him about the woman?
Yes, Alfred, I told him everything. He's a vicious bastard. I don't like him. I'd watch out for him if I were you.
Was there anyone with him?
Yes, tall fellow. Handsome, like a film star. Blonde, blue eyes. A real German Superman. Thin, though. Skinny as a stick.
Did the stick have a name?
Becker threw his head back and made a show of searching his memory.
Christ, it was a funny name. A tool or something.
Becker pinched the bridge of his nose.
No, something you use in the house. Mop? Bucket? No, broom. That's it. Broom. Imagine that. The guy looks like a fucking stick and calls himself Broom. You English have a marvelous sense of humor sometimes.
Vickery had collected the suitcase radio and was rapping his knuckle against the thick door.
Why don't you leave the radio, Alfred? It gets lonely here sometimes.
Sorry, Carl.
The door opened and Vickery stepped through.
Listen, Alfred. The cigarettes and chocolate were wonderful. But next time, bring a girl, will you?
Vickery went to the chief guard's office and asked for the logbooks for October and November. It took him a few moments, but he found the entry he was looking for. Date, 5-10-43. Prisoner, Becker, K. Number of visitors, 2. Names, department. No thank you. Chapter 25. Berlin.
My God, but it's cold this morning, said Brigadefuhrer Walter Schellenberg.
At least you still have a roof over your head, replied Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. The Halifaxes and Lancasters had quite a time last night. Hundreds dead, thousands homeless. So much for the invulnerability of our illustrious thousand-year Reich.
Canaris looked to Schellenberg for reaction. As always, he was struck by how young the man was. At just 33, he was head of Section 6 of the Sicherheitsdienst, better known as the SD, the Intelligence and Security Service of the SS. Section 6 was responsible for gathering intelligence on the Reich's enemies in foreign countries, an assignment very similar to that of the Abwehr. As a result, the two men were locked in a desperate competition. They were a mismatched pair, the short, laconic, white-haired old admiral who spoke with a slight lisp, the handsome, energetic, and thoroughly ruthless young Brigadefuhrer. The son of a Saarland piano maker, Schellenberg was personally recruited to the Nazi security apparatus by Reinhard Heydrich, the chief of the SD, who was assassinated by Czechoslovakian resistance fighters in May 1942. One of the Nazi Party's bright lights, Schellenberg thrived in its dangerous, paranoid atmosphere. His cathedral-like office was thoroughly bugged, and he had machine guns built into his desk, giving him the ability to kill a threatening visitor with the press of a button. On those rare occasions when he permitted himself to relax, Schellenberg liked to spend time with his elaborate collection of pornography. Once he displayed the photographs to Canaris the way a man might show snapshots of his family, boasting about the pictures he choreographed himself to satisfy his own bizarre sexual appetites. On his hand, Schellenberg wore a ring with a blue stone, beneath which lay a capsule of cyanide.
He had also been fitted with a false tooth containing a lethal measure of the poison. Now Schellenberg had just two goals: destroy Canaris and the Abwehr, and bring Adolf Hitler the most important secret of the war, the time and place of the Anglo-American invasion of France. Schellenberg had nothing but disdain for the Abwehr and the cluster of old officers surrounding Canaris, whom he derisively referred to as Santa Clauses. Canaris knew perfectly well Schellenberg was gunning for him, yet between the two there existed an uneasy truce. Schellenberg treated the old admiral with deference and respect. Canaris genuinely admired the brash, brilliant young officer and enjoyed his company. Which was why they began most mornings the same way, riding side by side on horseback through the Tiergarten. It gave each man a chance to check up on what the other was doing, to spar, to probe for weakness. Canaris liked their rides for one other reason. He knew that for at least 1 hour each morning the young general was not actively plotting his demise.
"There you go again, Herr Admiral," Schellenberg said. "Always looking at the dark side of things. I suppose that makes you a cynic, doesn't it?"
"I am not a cynic, Herr Brigadefuhrer. I'm a skeptic. There's an important difference." Schellenberg laughed.
"That's the difference between us in the Sicherheitsdienst and you old-school types in the Abwehr. We see nothing but endless possibility. You see nothing but danger. We are bold, not afraid to take risks. You prefer to have your head in the sand. No offense, Herr Admiral."
"None taken, my young friend. You're entitled to your opinion, however misinformed it might be." Canaris's horse threw back its head and snorted. The breath froze into a cloud, then drifted away on the gentle morning wind. Canaris looked around him at the devastation of the Tiergarten. Most of the lime and chestnut trees were gone, burned by Allied incendiary bombs. Ahead of them, on the pathway, was a bomb crater the size of a Kübelwagen. Thousands more were scattered throughout the park. Canaris, tugging on the reins, led his horse around it. A pair of Schellenberg's security men trailed softly after them on foot. Another walked a few feet in front of them, head slowly wheeling from side to side. Canaris knew there were more he could not see, even with his well-trained eye.
"Something very interesting landed on my desk yesterday evening," Schellenberg said.
"Oh, really? What was her name?"
Schellenberg, laughing, spurred the horse into a light trot. "I have a source in London. He did some work for the NKVD a long time ago, including recruiting an Oxford student who is now an officer inside MI5. He still talks to the man from time to time, and he hears things. He passes those things on to me. The MI5 officer is a Russian agent, but I share in the harvest, so to speak."
"Remarkable," Canaris said dryly.
"Churchill and Roosevelt don't trust Stalin. They keep him in the dark. They have refused to tell him anything about the time and place of the invasion. They think Stalin might leak the secret to us so the Allies will be destroyed in France. With the British and Americans out of the fight, Stalin would try to finish us off alone and grab all of Europe for himself."
"I've heard that theory. I'm not sure I put much stock in it."
"In any case, my agent says MI5 is in crisis. He says your man Fogel has mounted an operation that has scared the pants off them. The investigation is being led by a case officer named Vickery. Ever heard of him?"
"Alfred Vickery," Canaris said. "A former professor at University College in London."
"Very impressive," Schellenberg said genuinely.
"Part of being an effective intelligence officer is knowing your opponent, Herr Brigadefuhrer." Canaris hesitated, allowing time for Schellenberg to absorb the jab. "I'm glad Kurt is giving them a run for their money."
"The situation is so tense, Vickery has met with Churchill personally to update him on the progress of his investigation."
"That's not so surprising, Herr Brigadefuhrer. Vickery and Churchill are old friends."
Canaris cast a sideways glance at Schellenberg to see if his face registered any trace of surprise. Their conversations often turned into point-scoring contests,
each man trying to surprise the other with titbits of intelligence. Vickery is the well-known historian. I've read his work. I'm surprised you haven't. He has a keen mind. He thinks like Churchill. He was warning the world about you and your friends long before anyone took notice.
So what is Fogel up to? Perhaps the SD can be of some assistance.
Canaris permitted himself a rare but short burst of laughter. Please, Brigadefuhrer Schellenberg, if you're going to be so transparent, these morning rides will lose their appeal very quickly. Besides, if you want to know what Fogel is doing, just ask the chicken farmer. I know he's bugged our telephones and planted his spies inside Tirpitz Ufer.
Interesting you should say that. I raised that very question with Reichsführer Himmler over dinner last night. It seems Fogel is very careful, very secretive. I hear he doesn't even keep his files in the Abwehr Central Registry.
Fogel is the true paranoid and extremely cautious. He keeps everything in his office. And I wouldn't think about trying to get rough with him. He has an assistant named Werner Ulbricht, who's seen the worst of this war. The man's always cleaning his Lugers. Even I don't go near Fogel's office.
Schellenberg pulled back on the reins until his horse came to a stop. The morning was still and quiet. In the distance came the growl of the morning's first traffic along the Wilhelmstrasse.
Fogel is the kind of man we like in the SD. Intelligent. Driven.
There's only one problem, Canaris said. Fogel's a human being. He has a heart and a conscience. Something tells me he wouldn't fit in with your crowd.
Why don't you let the two of us meet? Perhaps we can think of some way to pool our resources for the good of the Reich. There's no reason for the SD and the Abwehr to be always at each other's throats, like this.
Canaris smiled. We're at each other's throats, Brigadefuhrer Schellenberg, because you are convinced I am a traitor to the Reich, and because you tried to have me arrested.
Which was true. Schellenberg had assembled a file containing dozens of allegations of treason committed by Canaris. In 1942 he gave the file to Heinrich Himmler, but Himmler took no action. Canaris kept dossiers, too, and Schellenberg suspected the Abwehr file on Himmler contained material the Reichsführer would rather not be made public.
That was a long time ago, Herr Admiral.
It's in the past.
Canaris jabbed the heel of his riding boot into his horse, and they started moving again. The stables appeared in the distance.
May I be so bold as to offer an interpretation of your offer to be of assistance, Brigadefuhrer Schellenberg?
Of course.
You would like to be a part of this operation for one of two reasons. Reason one, you could sabotage the operation in order to further lower the reputation of the Abwehr. Or, reason two, you could steal Fogel's intelligence and claim all the credit and glory for yourself.
Schellenberg slowly shook his head.
This mistrust between us. Such a pity. So distressing.
Yes, isn't it?
They rode together into the stables and dismounted. A pair of stable boys scampered out and led the horses away.
A pleasure, as always, Canaris said. Shall we take breakfast together?
I'd love to, but I'm afraid duty calls.
Oh?
A meeting with Himmler and Hitler, 8 o'clock sharp.
Lucky you. What's the topic?
Walter Schellenberg smiled and laid his gloved hand on the older man's shoulder.
Wouldn't you like to know? How was the old fox this morning?
Adolf Hitler said as Walter Schellenberg walked through the door at precisely 8 o'clock. Himmler was there, sitting on the overstuffed sofa, sipping coffee. It was the image Schellenberg liked to present to his superiors, too busy to arrive for a meeting early and engage in small talk, disciplined enough to be prompt.
As cagey as ever,
Schellenberg said, pouring himself a cup of the steaming coffee. There was a jug with real milk. Even the staff at the SD had trouble securing a steady supply these days.
You refuse to tell me anything about Fogel's operation.
He claims he knows nothing about it. He has permitted Fogel to work under extremely secretive circumstances, allowing himself to be kept in the dark about the details.
Perhaps it's better that way, Himmler said, his face impassive, his voice betraying no emotion whatsoever. The less the good admiral knows, the less he can betray to the enemy.
I've done some investigating of my own, Schellenberg said. I know that Fogel has sent at least one new agent into England. He had to use the Luftwaffe for the drop, and the pilot who flew the mission was very cooperative. Schellenberg opened his briefcase and withdrew two copies of the same file, handing one to Hitler and the other to Himmler. The agent's name is Horst Neumann. The Reichsfuhrer may remember that business in Paris some time back. An SS man was killed in a bar in Paris. Neumann was the man involved in that.
Himmler let the file fall from his hands onto the coffee table around which they were seated. For the Abwehr to use such a man as a direct slap in the face to the SS and the memory of the man he murdered. It shows Fogel's contempt for the party and the Führer.
Hitler was still reading the file and seemed genuinely interested in it. Perhaps Neumann is simply the right man for the job, Herr Reichsführer. Look at his dossier. Born in England, decorated member of the Fallschirmjäger. Knight's Cross, oak leaves. On paper, a very remarkable man. The Führer was more lucid and reasonable than Schellenberg had seen him in some time.
I agree, Schellenberg said. Except for the one blight on his record, Neumann appears to be an extraordinary soldier.
Himmler cast a cadaverous glance at Schellenberg. He didn't appreciate being contradicted in front of the Führer, no matter how brilliant Schellenberg might be.
Perhaps we should make our move against Canaris now, Himmler said. Remove him, place Brigadeführer Schellenberg in charge, and combine the Abwehr and the SD into one powerful intelligence agency. That way, Brigadeführer Schellenberg can oversee Fogel's operation personally. Things seem to have a way of going awry where Admiral Canaris is involved.
Again, Hitler disagreed with his most trusted aide.
If Schellenberg's Russian friend is correct, this man Fogel seems to have the British on the run. To step in now would be a mistake. No, Herr Reichsführer, Canaris remains in place for the time being. Perhaps he's doing something right for a change.
Hitler stood up.
Now, if you gentlemen will excuse me, I have other matters that demand my attention.
Two Mercedes staff cars were waiting at the curbside, engines running. There was an awkward moment while deciding whose car to take, but Schellenberg quietly relented and climbed in the back of Himmler's. He felt vulnerable when he wasn't surrounded by his security men, even when he was with Himmler. During the short drive, Schellenberg's armored Mercedes never strayed more than a few feet from the rear bumper of Himmler's limousine.
An impressive performance, as always, Herr Brigadeführer, Himmler said.
Schellenberg knew his superior well enough to realize the remark was not meant as a compliment. Himmler, the second most powerful man in Germany, was peeved at being contradicted in front of the Führer.
Thank you, Herr Reichsführer.
The Führer wants the secret of the invasion so badly it is clouding his judgment, Himmler said matter-of-factly. It is our job to protect him. Do you understand what I'm saying to you, Herr Brigadeführer?
Absolutely.
I want to know what Fogel is playing at. If the Führer won't let us do it from the inside, we'll have to do it from the outside. Put Fogel and his assistant Ulbricht under 24-hour surveillance. Use every means at your disposal to penetrate Tirpitz-Ufer. Also, find some way of getting a man into the radio center at Hamburg. Fogel has to communicate with his agents. I want someone listening to what's being said.
Yes, Herr Reichsführer.
And, Walter, don't look so glum. We'll get our hands around the Abwehr soon enough. Don't worry. It will be all yours.
Thank you, Herr Reichsführer.
Unless, of course, you ever contradict me in front of the Führer again.
Himmler rapped on the glass partition so softly it was almost inaudible. The car pulled to the side of the curb, as did Schellenberg's, directly behind them. The young general sat motionless until one of his security men appeared at the door to accompany him on the 10-foot walk back to his own car. Chapter 26. London. Catherine Blake was by now thoroughly regretting her decision to go to the Popes for help. Yes, they had given her a meticulous account of Peter Jordan's life in London, but it had come at a very steep price. She had been threatened with extortion, drawn into a bizarre sexual game, and been forced to murder two people. Now the police were involved. The murder of a prominent black marketeer and underworld figure like Vernon Pope was big news in all the London newspapers. The police had misled the newspapermen, though. They said the victims had been found with their throats slit, not stabbed through the eye and through the heart. They were obviously trying to filter out crank leads from real ones. Or was MI5 already involved? According to the newspapers, the police wanted to question Robert Pope, but had been unable to find him. Catherine could be of assistance. Pope was sitting 20 feet from her in the Savoy Bar, angrily nursing a whiskey. Why was Pope there? Catherine thought she knew the answer. Pope was there because he suspected Catherine was involved in his brother's murder. Finding her would not be difficult for him. Pope knew Catherine was looking for Peter Jordan. All he had to do was go to the places frequented by Peter Jordan, and there was a good chance Catherine would appear. She turned her back to him. She was not afraid of Robert Pope. He was more a nuisance than a threat. As long as she remained in full view, he would be reluctant to take action against her. Catherine had expected this. As a precaution, she had started carrying her pistol at all times. It was necessary, but annoying. She had to carry a larger handbag to conceal the weapon. It was heavy and banged against her hip when she walked. The gun, ironically, was also a threat to her security. Try explaining to a London police officer why you're carrying a German-made Mauser pistol equipped with a silencer. Deciding whether to kill Robert Pope was not Catherine Blake's biggest worry, for at that moment Peter Jordan walked into the bar of the Savoy along with Shepherd Ramsay. She wondered which man would make the first move. Things were about to get interesting.
"I'll say one good thing about this war," Shepherd Ramsay said, as he and Peter Jordan sat down at a corner table. "It's done wonders for my net worth. While I've been over here playing hero, my stocks have been soaring. We've made more money during the past 6 months than I did for 10 years working at Dad's insurance company. Why don't you tell old Dad to shove off? He'd be lost without me."
Shepherd signaled the waiter and ordered a martini. Jordan ordered a double scotch.
"Tough day at the office, honey?"
"Brutal."
"The rumor mill says you're working on a diabolical new secret weapon."
"I'm an engineer, Shep. I build bridges and roads."
"Any idiot could do that. You're not over here building a goddamned highway."
"No, I'm not."
"So when are you going to tell me what you're working on?"
"I can't. You know I can't."
"It's just me, old Shep. You can tell me anything."
"I'd love to, Shepherd, but if I told you, I'd have to kill you. And then Sally would be a widow and Kippy would have no father."
"Kippy's in trouble at Buckley again. Goddamned kid gets in more trouble than I did."
"Now that's saying something."
"The headmaster's threatening to throw him out. Sally had to go over the other day and listen to a lecture about how Kippy needs a strong male influence in his life."
"I never knew he had one."
"Very funny, asshole. Sally's having trouble with the car. Says the thing needs tires, but she can't buy new ones because of rationing. Says they couldn't open up the Oyster Bay house for Christmas this year because there was no fuel oil to heat the damn thing."
Shepherd noticed Jordan was studying his drink.
"I'm sorry, Peter. Am I boring you?"
"No more than usual."
"I just thought some news from home might cheer you up."
"Who says I need cheering up?"
"Peter Jordan, I haven't seen that look on your face in a very long time."
"Who is she?"
"I have no idea."
Would you like to explain that?
I bumped into her in the blackout, literally. Knocked her groceries out of her arms. It was very embarrassing, but there was something about her.
Did you get her telephone number?
No.
How about a name?
Yes, I got a name.
Well, that's something. Jesus Christ, I'd say you're a little out of practice. Tell me how she looked.
Peter Jordan told him. Tall, brown hair falling across her shoulders, a wide mouth, beautiful cheekbones, and the most spectacular eyes he had ever seen.
That's interesting, Shepherd said.
Why?
Because that woman is standing right over there.
Men in uniform generally made Catherine Blake nervous, but as Peter Jordan crossed the bar toward her, she thought she had never seen a man look quite so handsome as he did in his dark blue American naval uniform. He was a strikingly attractive man. She had not noticed how attractive the previous evening. His uniform jacket fitted him perfectly through his square shoulders and chest, as though it had been cut for him by a tailor in Manhattan. He was trim at the waist, and his walk had a smooth confidence about it that only self-possessed successful men have. His hair was dark, nearly black, and in striking contrast to his pale complexion. His eyes were a distracting shade of green, pale green like a cat's, his mouth soft and sensuous. It broke into an easy smile when he noticed she was looking at him. "I believe I bumped into you in the blackout last night," he said, and stuck out his hand. "My name is Peter Jordan." She took his hand, then absently allowed her fingernails to trail across the palm of his hand when she released her grip.
"My name is Catherine Blake," she said.
"Yes, I remember. You look as though you're waiting for someone."
"I am, but it appears he's stood me up."
"Well, I'd say he's a damned fool, then."
"He's just an old friend, actually."
"Can I buy you that drink now?"
Jordan asked. Catherine looked at Jordan and smiled. Then she glanced across the bar at Robert Pope, who was watching them intently.
"Actually, I would love to go somewhere a little more quiet to talk. Do you still have all that food at your house?"
"A couple of eggs, some cheese, maybe a can of tomatoes, and lots of wine."
"Sounds like the makings of a wonderful omelette to me."
"Let me get my coat."
Robert Pope, standing at the bar, watched them as they slipped through the crowd and into the salon. He calmly finished his drink, waited a few seconds, then left the bar and trailed quietly after them. Outside the hotel, they were shown into a cab by the doorman. Pope, walking quickly across the street, watched the cab drive away. Dickie Dobbs was sitting behind the wheel of the van. He started the motor as Pope climbed inside. The van slipped away from the curb, into the evening traffic. "No need to rush," Pope told Dickie. He knew where they were headed. He leaned back and closed his eyes for a few minutes as Dickie drove westward toward Jordan's townhouse in Kensington. During the taxi ride to Peter Jordan's house, Catherine Blake realized quite suddenly that she was nervous. It was not because a man who possessed the most important secret of the war was sitting next to her. She was just not very good at this, the rituals of courtship and dating. For the first time in a very long time, she thought about her appearance. She knew she was an attractive woman, a beautiful woman. She knew most men desired her. But during her time in Britain, she had gone to great lengths to conceal her appearance, to blend in. She had adopted the look of an aggrieved war widow, heavy dark stockings that hid the shape of her long legs, poor-fitting skirts that masked the curve of her hips, chunky mannish sweaters that concealed her rounded breasts. Tonight she was dressed in a striking gown she had bought before the war, appropriate for drinks at the Savoy. Even so, for the first time in her life, Catherine worried about whether she was pretty enough. Something else was bothering Catherine. Why did it take circumstances like these for her finally to be with a man like Peter Jordan? He was intelligent and attractive and successful and, well, apparently normal. Most of the other men Catherine had known would be behaving very differently by now. She remembered the first time with Maria Romero's father, Emilio.
He had not bothered with flowers or romance. He barely even kissed her. He just pushed her down onto the bed and fucked her. And Catherine had not minded. In fact, she rather liked it that way. Sex was not something to be done out of love and respect. She didn't even enjoy the conquest. For Catherine, it was an act of pure physical gratification. Emilio Romero understood. Unfortunately, Emilio understood many things about her. She had given up long ago on the idea of falling in love, getting married and having children. Her obsessive independence and deeply ingrained mistrust of people would never allow her to make the emotional commitment to a marriage. Her selfishness and self-indulgence would never permit her to care for a child. She never felt safe with a man unless she was in total control, emotionally and physically. These feelings manifested themselves in the act of sex itself. Catherine had discovered long ago that she was incapable of having an orgasm unless she was on top. She had formed an image of the kind of life she wanted for herself. When the war was over, she would go somewhere warm, the Costa del Sol, the south of France, Italy perhaps, and buy herself a small villa overlooking the sea. She would live alone and cut off her hair and lie on the beach until her skin was deep brown. And if she needed a man, she would bring him to her villa and use his body until she was satisfied, and then she would throw him out and sit by her fire and be alone again with the sound of the sea. Perhaps she would let Maria stay with her sometimes. Maria was the only one who understood her. That's why it hurt Catherine so much that Maria had betrayed her. Catherine didn't hate herself for the way she was, nor did she love herself. On the few occasions when she had reflected on her own psychology, she had thought of herself as a rather interesting character. She had also come to the realization that she was perfectly suited to being a spy, emotionally, physically, and intellectually. Fogel had recognized this, and so had Emilio. She loathed them both, but she could not find fault with their conclusions. When she gazed at her reflection in the mirror now, one word came to mind: spy. The taxi drew to a halt in front of Jordan's house. He took her hand to help her out of the car, then paid off the driver. He unlocked the front door to the house and showed her inside. He closed the door before turning on the lights. Blackout rules. For an instant, Catherine felt disoriented and exposed. She didn't like being in a strange place with a strange man in the dark. Jordan quickly switched on the lights and illuminated the room. "My goodness," she said. "How did you get a billet like this? I thought all American officers were packed into hotels and boarding houses." Catherine knew the answer, of course, but she needed to ask the question. It was rare for an American officer to be living alone in such a place. "My father-in-law bought the house years ago. He spent a great deal of time in London on both business and pleasure, and decided he wanted a pied-à-terre here. I have to admit I'm glad he bought it. The thought of spending the war packed like a sardine in Grosvenor House really doesn't appeal to me. Here, let me take your coat." He helped her off with her overcoat and went to hang it in the closet. Catherine surveyed the drawing room. It was handsomely furnished with the sort of deep leather couches and chairs one finds in a private London club. The walls were panelled. The wood floors were stained a deep brown and polished to a lustrous shine. The rugs scattered about were of excellent quality. There was one unique feature about the room. The walls were covered with photographs of bridges.
"You're married, then?"
Catherine said, making sure there was a slight note of disappointment in her voice. "I beg your pardon?" he said, returning to the room.
"You said your father-in-law owns this house."
"I suppose I should say my former father-in-law. My wife was killed in an automobile accident before the war."
"I'm sorry, Peter. I didn't mean to..."
"Please, it's fine. It was a long time ago." She nodded toward the wall and said,
"You like bridges?"
"You might say that. Yes. I build them." Catherine walked across the room and looked at one of the photographs close up. It was the Hudson River Bridge for which Jordan had been named Engineer of the Year in 1938.
"You designed these?"
"Actually, architects design them. I'm an engineer. They put a design on paper, and I tell them whether the thing will stand up or not. Sometimes I make them change the design.
Sometimes, if it's terrific, like that one, I find a way to make it work.
Sounds challenging.
It can be, he said. But sometimes it can be tedious and dull, and it makes for boring conversation at cocktail parties.
I didn't know the Navy needed bridges.
They don't. Jordan hesitated. I'm sorry, I can't discuss my...
Please, believe me, I understand the rules.
I could do the cooking, but I couldn't guarantee that the food would be edible.
Just show me where the kitchen is.
Through that door. If you don't mind, I'd like to change. I still can't get used to wearing this damned uniform.
Certainly.
She watched his next movements very carefully. He removed his keys from his trouser pocket and unlocked a door. That would be his study. He switched on the light and was inside for less than a minute. When he emerged, Jordan was no longer carrying his briefcase. He probably locked it inside his safe. He climbed the stairs. His bedroom was on the second floor. It was perfect. While he was sleeping upstairs, she could break into his safe and photograph the contents of his briefcase. Neumann would make sure the photographs reached Berlin, and the Abwehr analysts would examine them to discover the nature of Peter Jordan's work. She went through the doorway into the kitchen and was struck by a flash of panic. Why was he suddenly changing out of his uniform? Had she done something wrong? Made some mistake? Was he on the phone right now to MI5? Was MI5 calling Special Branch? Would he come downstairs and sweet-talk her until they broke down the door and arrested her? Catherine forced herself to relax. It was ludicrous. When she opened the door to the refrigerator, she realized something. She didn't have the vaguest idea how to make an omelette. Maria made excellent omelettes. She would just imitate everything she did. From the refrigerator, she took 3 eggs, a small pat of butter, and a chunk of cheddar. She opened the door to the small pantry and found a tin of tomatoes and a bottle of wine. She opened it, found the wine glasses, and poured for them both. She didn't wait until Jordan returned to try the wine. It was delicious. She could taste wildflowers and lavender and apricot, and it made her think of her imaginary villa. Warm the tomatoes first, that's what Maria did, except before, in Paris, the tomatoes were fresh tomatoes, not these beastly tinned ones. She opened the tomatoes, drained off the water, chopped them, and dropped them into a hot pan. The kitchen immediately took on the smell of the tomatoes, and she drank some more wine before cracking and beating the eggs and grating the cheese into a bowl. She had to smile. The domestic routine of making dinner for a man felt so odd to her. Then she thought, perhaps Kurt Vogel should add a cooking course to his little Abwehr spy school. Jordan set the table in the dining room while Catherine finished with the omelette. He had changed into cotton khaki trousers and a sweater, and Catherine was again struck by his looks. She wanted to let down her hair, to do something to make herself more attractive to him, but she stayed within the character she had created for herself. The omelette was surprisingly good, and they both ate it very quickly before it could go cold, washing it down with the wine, a pre-war Bordeaux Jordan had brought to London from New York. By the end of the meal, Catherine felt pleasant and relaxed. Jordan seemed that way, too. He appeared to suspect nothing, appeared to accept that their meeting was wholly coincidental. "Have you ever been to the States?" he asked, as they cleared away the dishes and carried them into the kitchen.
"Actually, I lived in Washington for 2 years when I was a little girl."
"Really?"
"Yes, my father worked at the Foreign Office. He was a diplomat. He was posted in Washington in the early 20s, after the Great War. I liked it very much. Except for the heat, of course. My goodness, but Washington is oppressive in the summer. My father rented a cottage for us on the Chesapeake Bay for the summers. I have very fond memories of that time."
All true, except Catherine's father had worked for the German Foreign Ministry, not the British Foreign Office. Catherine had decided it was best to draw on as many aspects of her own life as possible.
"Is your father still a diplomat?"
"No, he died before the war."
"And your mother?"
"My mother died when I was a very little girl."
Catherine stacked the dirty dishes in the sink.
"I'll wash if you dry."
"Forget it. I have a woman who comes a couple of times a week. She'll be here in the morning. How about a glass of brandy?"
That would be nice.
There were photographs in silver frames over the fireplace, and she looked at them while Jordan poured the brandy. He joined her in front of the fire and handed her one of the glasses.
Your wife was very beautiful.
Yes, she was. Her death was very hard on me.
And your son? Who's caring for him now?
Margaret's sister, Jane. She sipped her brandy and smiled at him.
You don't sound terribly thrilled about that.
My God, is it that obvious?
Yes, it is.
Jane and I never really got along very well, and frankly, I wish Billy wasn't in her care. She's selfish and petty and spoiled rotten, and I'm afraid she's going to make Billy the same way. But I really had no choice. The day after I joined the Navy, I was sent to Washington, and 2 weeks after that, I was flown to London.
Billy is the image of his father, Catherine said. I'm certain you have nothing to worry about.
Jordan smiled and said, I hope you're right. Please sit down.
Are you sure? I don't want to keep you.
I haven't had an evening as pleasant as this in a very long time. Please stay a little longer. They sat down next to each other on the large leather couch. Jordan said, So, tell me how it is that an incredibly beautiful woman like you isn't married. Catherine felt her face flush. My goodness, you're actually blushing. Don't tell me no one has ever told you before that you're beautiful. She smiled and said,
No, it's just been a very long time.
Well, that makes two of us. It's been a very long time since I've told a woman that she was beautiful. In fact, I can remember the last time. It was when I woke up and saw Margaret's face on the day she died. I never thought I could find another woman beautiful after that, until I made a fool of myself by crashing into you in the blackout last night. You took my breath away, Catherine.
Thank you. I can assure you the attraction was mutual.
Is that why you didn't give me your telephone number?
I didn't want you to believe I was a wanton woman.
Darn, I was hoping you were a wanton woman.
Peter, she said,
and jabbed him in the leg with her finger. Are you ever going to answer my question? Why aren't you married? Catherine stared into the fire for a moment.
I was married. My husband, Michael, was shot down over the Channel the first week of the Battle of Britain. They never were able to recover his body. I was pregnant at the time, and I lost the baby. The doctors said it was the shock of Michael's death that did it.
Catherine's gaze shifted from the fire to Jordan's face.
He was handsome and brave, and he was my entire world. For the longest time after his death, I never looked twice at another man. I started dating a short time ago, but nothing at all serious. And then some foolish American who wasn't using his blackout torch smashed into me on a pavement in Kensington.
There was a long and slightly uncomfortable moment of silence. The fire was dying. Catherine could hear the sound of a rainstorm getting up and pattering against the pavement outside the window. She realized she could stay like this for quite a while, sitting next to the fire with her brandy and this kind and gentle man.
My God, Catherine, what's got into you?
She tried for a moment to make herself hate him, but she could not. She hoped he never did anything to threaten her, anything that would force her to kill him. She made a show of looking at her wristwatch.
My goodness, look at the time, she said. It's 11 o'clock. I've imposed on you too long. I should really be going.
What were you thinking just now? Jordan asked, as if he had not heard a word she had just said.
What was she thinking? A very good question. I realize you can't talk about your work, but I'm going to ask you one question, and I want you to tell me the truth.
Cross my heart.
You're not going to run off and get yourself killed, are you?
No, I'm not going to get myself killed. I promise. She leaned over and kissed him on the mouth. His lips did not respond. She pulled away, thinking, did I make a mistake? Perhaps he wasn't ready for this. He said, I'm sorry. It's just been a very long time.
It's been a very long time for me, too.
Maybe we need to try again. She smiled and kissed him again. This time his mouth responded to hers. He pulled her close to him, She enjoyed the sensation of her breasts pressing against him. After a moment she drew away.
If I don't leave now, I don't think I ever will.
I'm not sure I want you to leave. She gave him a final kiss and said,
When am I going to see you again?
Will you let me take you to dinner tomorrow night? A proper dinner, that is? Somewhere we can dance?
I'd love that.
How about the Savoy again, around 8 o'clock?
That sounds perfect.
Catherine Blake was brought back to reality by the cold blast of rain and the sight of Pope and Dickie sitting in a parked van. At least they had not interfered. Perhaps they were content to watch from a distance for the time being. The late-night traffic was light. She quickly flagged down a taxi on Brompton Road. She climbed in and asked the cabbie to take her to Victoria Station. Turning around, she saw Pope and Dickie following. At Victoria, she paid off the driver and went inside, melting into a crowd of passengers stepping from a late-arriving train. She glanced over her shoulder as Dickie Dobbs came running into the terminus, head wheeling from side to side. Quickly, she walked out through another door, vanishing into the blackout.